This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think for a lot of people in the scientific community, we really need to listen to civil rights advocates. We need to listen to people from marginalized communities within science who are talking to us about things like how science is used and abused in the criminal justice system, who are talking about how big data is abused to gerrymander people out of districts and dilute their votes, particularly Black communities. And we need to see these connections between science and civil rights. And if our community doesn't address them, I think we're failing a big part of society and we're not living up to the mission that science should have, which is being a force for truth and for light and for justice in our world.
Science is a required subject from kindergarten through 12th grade. It's not only a set of facts, it's a way of thinking that has served as the engine for change. Yet, in the political landscape of the U.S., science has somehow become a controversial and even divisive topic. How have we arrived at this reality, wherein some people actively oppose the systematic search for knowledge? This week on Sea Change Radio, we check in with science communicator Aaron Huertas about his advocacy work. We discuss the fight for science justice, talk about the intersection of religion, science, and politics, and look at some examples of how political divisions in this country damage the science community and ultimately all of us. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Aaron Huertas. He is the founder of Science Communication Media, and he's a science communicator. Aaron, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
So you recently penned a piece on your blog at your Medium site, which we will link to on seachangeradio.com. It's entitled, What Does the Scientific Community Advocate For? The Case for Science Justice. Now, first, what is science justice?
Science justice is a term that I first ran into when I was volunteering with the March for Science, and I've kept coming back to it because it has such an obvious parallel in my mind to environmental justice. And as someone who's worked in climate communication and climate advocacy for so long, the past several years, I've seen the climate advocacy community do so much more to center issues of environmental justice and to center frontline communities that are dealing with climate change and pollution right now in their advocacy. And I feel like science advocacy can do the same thing and think a lot more about the inequities that are at the heart of a lot of the issues that we care about.
So you write, in practical terms, a scientific community that, quote, promotes diversity in STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math, and sometimes arts can get thrown in there and make it STEAM, but doesn't do anything to fight societal discrimination, fundamentally limits its ability to promote diversity in STEM. So how does a parent, an educator, somebody involved in their community fight to promote diversity in STEM without alienating others? What is the best path, in your view, for people to promote science in their at a community level?
Well, you know, I think if you talk to most people in science advocacy, they'll recognize that diversity in STEM is something that's important, and they'll want to support more outreach to people from historically marginalized communities and currently marginalized communities and try to get them into what they call the STEM pipeline to say, you know, here's how you can pursue a scientific degree and a scientific career. But then if you talk about some of these more fundamental issues in society about who even gets the chance to become a scientist based on their access to basic educational resources, a lot of times our community science advocates won't see that as their issue. So if you talk about how the education system is still so tied to local property taxes and how that perpetuates inequities and prevents students from getting access to science education and scientific tools, starting right from the outset when they're in elementary school, that time when they're really curious and might pursue a scientific career, the resources aren't there. So is our community fighting for those resources? And I think if we're not fighting for those resources, and if we're not showing up to these fights to make access to education more equitable, we can't really say that we're promoting diversity in STEM at the most basic levels.
And the example you give, which I want to dig into a little bit here, is the case of tainted water in Flint, Michigan. How is that illustrative of scientific justice, or in this case, injustice?
I think it's really systemic. Flint is one of the few majority black cities in the United States. They had a democratically elected city council that didn't want to switch their water supply. They were overruled by a Republican-appointed emergency manager. Their water supply got switched. It was tainted water. Unfortunately, you had state employees, including scientists, who censored data and lied about the water being tainted. You had independent scientists from Virginia Tech and Dr. Monahana Atisha, who exposed that contamination and blew the whistle and empowered that community with accurate science and scientific tools and brought science justice to bear in Flint. And if you look at Flint and you see all these inequity issues, how can you go to a kid in Flint and say you have a future in STEM if part of the scientific community literally just betrayed your community by censoring that data? So I think these justice issues are something that's truly fundamental to how we do science advocacy and how we think about the type of science society supports and what science advocacy can do to really serve people and improve their lives.
And now we're living in a very crazy, dark time for scientists, people working for deep-pocketed agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency are fearing for their jobs. People are kind of clinging to what is safe right now in that community, which is a real problem when scientists need to be able to be free to take chances, to try to think outside the box. Maybe you could give us an example of how science has been adversely affected since the beginning of the Trump administration.
The biggest problem in my mind has been censorship, and that's what's woken a lot of people who are relatively new to science advocacy up to the need to engage more directly in politics. One of the first things the Trump administration did when they came into office was pressure the National Park Service to misrepresent the size of the inauguration crowd on the National Mall. And that set off a chain of events in which the National Park Service started censoring and shutting down their Twitter accounts, and a couple of the National Park Service Twitter accounts went rogue and started tweeting out climate facts in defiance of the Trump administration. So, yeah, that was kind of a silly example to kick things off, but the censorship has continued. There's at least 40,000 public data sets that have either been buried or scrubbed from the internet. Federal data sets, information that belongs to you, me, and everybody else in the country. And for scientists and for science advocates, I think we look at censorship and say censorship is bad because it hides the truth, and it's always bad to hide data. And if you nerd out with some scientists, they'll say, well, you can't censor the data because then how do you reproduce the study? And we think about it in the terms of professional norms of science. But really, censorship hurts people at such a visceral level, just like it did in Flint. When you hide information from people, you're denying them their basic right to that information. And when you cut these programs that monitor lead in the water, that do clean air and clean water monitoring, you're putting people at risk. You're denying them their basic right to information about the environment in which they live, and that has really negative and immediate repercussions on public health. So I think we need to look at science advocacy more holistically and actually think about how data is abused and misused and how censorship really limits which issues we even allow people to regard as important in society.
But there's one thing, Mama, I think you should know. It is not love that makes the flowers grow, but a complex electron transfer process known as photosynthesis when chlorophyll reacts with the light of day. Since you're gone, the light has gone away. There's one more thing, Mama, I think that you'll find. It is not love that makes the stars shine, or the spontaneous combustion of superheated, supercondensed gases in a process known as fusion that creates new elements when the time is right. Since you're gone, stars don't shine so bright. Oh, there's another thing, Mama. I think I should confide. It is not love. That'll turn the tide. But the net difference in the gravitational pull between the Earth and the Moon as it is acted out upon the waves. But since you're gone, I feel washed away. I could have been a mathematician, studied rockets for a living, would have worked out better in the end. But to get more specific, I break every law of physics to bring you back to me again.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to science communicator Aaron Huertas. So Aaron, you write in your piece, "This is identity politics. When senior scientists like Steven Pinker dismiss civil rights and discrimination as identity politics, they demonstrate that they have not taken the points their colleagues and civil rights advocates are raising seriously. Almost all politics is identity politics. The problem is that some people are oppressed because of their identity." Connecting those dots with scientists themselves, how is a scientist supposed to wend their way through the new age of identity politics successfully while still being able to promote themselves in academia or in government work, etc.?
I think we have to recognize that there are so many incentives in science advocacy to play it safe and to keep our heads down and to try to not be controversial. And that goes back to the Cold War era in the United States and scientists who were censored, who spoke out when it came to talking about nuclear weapons and the dangers that they pose to society. And it extends through to a lot of the nonprofit advocacy that we do in the United States, because the ways that our laws work, nonprofit advocates at what are called 501c3 organizations under the Internal Revenue Code can't engage in what's called electioneering. So a lot of lawyers will tell you the safest way to play it if you work at a 501c3 organization is to never call out a politician by name and never call out a political party by name. And that creates a soft form of censorship when we do advocacy work. And it creates an incentive to not rock the boat and not call things out when they perpetuate systemic racism. So I think for a lot of people in the scientific community, we really need to listen to civil rights advocates. We need to listen to people from marginalized communities within science who are talking to us about things like how science is used and abused in the criminal justice system, who are talking about how big data is abused to gerrymander people out of districts and dilute their votes, particularly Black communities. And we need to see these connections between science and civil rights. And if our community doesn't address them, I think we're failing a big part of society and we're not living up to the mission that science should have, which is being a force for truth and for light and for justice in our world.
What about connecting the science community back to the religious community? It seems like those two parts of our country have become more divisive and bifurcated than any time really since the Industrial Revolution. It seems like religious people who believe in science are forced to make a choice in today's political world. But I don't think you really see it that way, do you?
You know, I had a big change because when I was younger, I grew up with a lot of science books and a lot of science communication that I would consider anti-religious. And particularly around issues having to do with, say, evolution in the classroom, I definitely viewed religion as the opposite of science somehow. And the best corrective I could have possibly received was working with scientists who are also religious and really understanding that these values don't have to be in conflict and we don't have to buy into those narratives. Religion and spirituality is a big way that lots and lots of people all around the world understand their lives and their relationship to one another. And it would be wrong for scientists or science advocates to diminish that as a way of knowing or as a way of living And really, they don't have to be incompatible. I think one of the best examples of work in this field is from Catherine Hayhoe, who's an evangelical Christian and a climate scientist. And she can talk to evangelical Christian audiences about creation care and climate science in a way that, you know, an atheist or agnostic scientist simply couldn't. So I think we have to recognize that, you know, we owe it to society to approach things in a way that's respectful to every audience and their way of seeing the world, too. We shouldn't approach science advocacy or science communication as if the scientific way of thinking about things is the only way of thinking about things or the only valid way of thinking about things.
I mean, ultimately, the two different tranches of thought, let's just divide them for argument's sake, of religion versus science, they're all putting a lot of weight in the value of mankind, right? Well, especially the anti-choice movement, which says that every life is sacred, and equating humanity with the holy. You would think that great achievements by humans, and we can put some of our best scientists along with our greatest achievements as a species right up there, you would think that that would make religious people feel a sense of pride in what humans are doing, and then maybe embrace the scientific community and its breakthroughs more instead of turning the other cheek. That's the disconnect that I have trouble with.
Well, I think if science is seen as cold and elitist and distant, that's when people turn off, right? And they don't see the scientific community as their allies or someone that's trying to help them out. I think if we look at the communitarian values that science has, the idea that people can come together to understand our world more coherently and that good can come from that and that we can work together to protect our air and protect our water and to make sure that people have access to medicine and public health, those sort of values I think are very much compatible with how religious groups think about community values too. So I'd like to see more science communication that sees those compatibilities. And I'd also like to see science advocacy that's, you know, respectful of religious communities, whether it's an evangelical Christian community, black or white, whether it's an indigenous community, just being respectful of other people's culture and ways of knowing about the world and really understanding that we should never go into any of these conversations thinking that everybody should think or act like a mini scientist, because that's just not how society functions.
Speaking of advocacy work within the science community, you are on the advisory board of an organization called 500 Women Scientists, and they do some pretty important work in terms of fighting discrimination in science. What is the organization's mission, and how is it relevant today?
Yeah, it was founded by a group of female scientists right after the 2016 election, who were shocked by the Trump win and really thought that everything that was going to happen to immigrants, the signal that the election sent about the country's tolerance for, frankly, for sexually assaulting women, that they had to address that and that they had to come together as a community to do that. And initially, the original open letter writers who wanted to talk about these issues, they thought, if I can get 500 other women scientists to sign this, that'll be great. And they wound up with something more like 15,000. And this is true for so many groups that cropped up after the election. We've all been kind of finding our groups who want to work on this stuff together. And over the past year, they've done a lot to host meetups at conferences so folks can build community with one another, to form pods in cities so they can support one another, and then to also do advocacy work to get scientific organizations and the big groups in science that host conferences, folks at universities, to pass policies that are more aggressive when it comes to fighting discrimination and fighting harassment. And there's definitely a focus on fighting sexual harassment and sexual assault right now. And that's got to be seen as inclusive of fighting all kinds of oppressive behavior, including racial discrimination, including discrimination based on people's immigration status and their religion, too.
And I also would imagine with the recent fury over sexual harassment that that would filter into the mission of these women scientists as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and you know, I think for the scientific community, they were one of the first communities to deal with public sexual harassment claims in recent history. A lot of this happened in the astronomy community, and you had a lot of reporting by BuzzFeed and other news outlets that exposed serial harassers in those fields. And that's happening in a lot of other fields, too. And that exposure is good. It's leading to a lot of necessary and difficult conversations that we need to have in the scientific community. And importantly for me, you know, I'm a white guy. That's how I grew up. I grew up with a white working class identity in coastal New Jersey. And what I've realized in taking on more of this work is that it's really important for me to be an ally, to understand that there are no perfect allies out there. We're always trying to be good allies and elevate other people's voices and make sure that we're also getting other people who are from relatively privileged backgrounds like us to also see these civil rights issues and to see their responsibility for getting off the sidelines and standing with these justice-seeking movements.
And how does 500 women scientists help these women scientists come forward with their experiences in the workplace?
At the most basic level, it creates community. So you have other people who understand these issues, who have also shared a lot of these experiences of discrimination, and in some cases, all the way through to harassment and assault. And it provides a peer network for people who've suffered from that discrimination so that they know they're not alone and so that they can work together, confide in each other, build community, and build power. And some members of that group and other people that they've worked with, they have come forward with their stories about harassment and assault. Sarah Myrie, a climate researcher that I've worked with for several years, has been upfront about her experiences being discriminated against as a female scientist. She writes for The Stranger in Seattle. And what she's done is really brave and really necessary for the community, and it's encouraged other people to come forward with their stories too. So I think we're seeing more of that in our community, and we just absolutely have to support the women who are coming forward with these stories, and we have to do more at a personal level and at an institutional level to combat this discrimination and combat this harassment. And that's everything from, you know, revisiting the way that we do human resources, the way that we process these complaints when people make them. And frankly, at an individual level, if you know somebody who is a harasser, to just stop working with them. That's one of the most powerful things you can do, especially as an ally, to say, no, enough. And speaking out against these harassers and these folks in our community who are making it not just harder, but in a lot of cases impossible for women or for people from any marginalized community to succeed in science.
I'm not familiar with the case of Sarah Myrie. Can you maybe expand on that?
Sarah's been really outspoken about the harassment and discrimination that she has suffered as a female scientist in our field, and also as a female scientist who has really taken her responsibility to communicate about climate change publicly very seriously. And she's written a bunch of articles for The Stranger in Seattle about this. And I would highly recommend reading them. It's a great example of a female scientist who is really sharing at a detailed level what it's been like for her day to day, from the dangers of feeling alone and exposed and vulnerable when doing field work all the way through to harassment and discrimination she's faced from senior male colleagues at the university where she works, who've treated her in a very demeaning way rather than treating her respectfully like a colleague with whom they disagree. So female scientists sharing those experiences, they're encouraging us and frankly, I think begging us to do more to address these issues in our field, because if science advocacy doesn't stop discrimination, we can't be an effective community. We can't be a community that helps the rest of the world with our science.
Bars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell, and there's no one there to raise them. It's just my job 5 days a week.
nothing tile my heart. I know, I don't know. I'm a rocket man. Rocket man, burning out as few as I can blow. And you think it's gonna be a long, long time.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to science communicator Aaron Huertas. Why don't you talk about another project that you're involved with, which is related to science in many ways, graduate students who are walking out in protest of the current GOP tax plan. What is the grad tax walkout?
Yeah, one of the things that the GOP tax plan does is it disallows graduate students from writing off their tuition. So the way that this would work is it would basically make it impossible for a lot of grad students to afford being grad students. It would be extremely disruptive to the way higher education works for them. And it's another example of something that you can look at as just tax policy and being unfair to all these graduate students. But importantly, it is totally inequitable, right? Students who from a lower income background, students who are from historically marginalized communities who are less likely to be able to afford that advanced education in the first place, that's going to make them harder to get scientific degrees or get any advanced degree. So it's another one of these issues where the science advocacy community has been really united against the grad school tax itself, and it can do more to stand with justice-seeking communities that want to address these fundamental issues of inequity in society.
Well, it's always great to hear of the important work you're doing, Aaron. I appreciate you catching us up on your efforts. Aaron Huertas, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Galactic, Josh Ritter, and Elton John.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.